internet. I'm Todd Kolkin, solo practitioner here in the great city of New York, and this is Intro to Non-For-Profit Law. Now, as a wee bit of background before we get started, my practice has two major practice areas. About two-thirds of it is corporate law and international finance. And the other third, which is my true passion, is non-for-profit law. What is non-for-profit law? I mean, essentially, it's representing any tax-exempt organization. We're going to go through that in detail in quite a bit. But what I find really helpful and interesting about this type of practice is you get to use the corporate law toolkit, especially the finance toolkit, for a tax-exempt purpose, which is usually something good for humanity. So, it can be very rewarding. I've certainly enjoyed it. I hope you will too. If you happen to be in this area of practice, great. If you're not as familiar with it, that's fine too. I'm going to break it down into its most basic components, and then we'll build you up from there. So that said, let's get into today's agenda. First and foremost, I'm going to give you the nonprofit basics, sort of define some basic terms, get you familiarized with some of the basic structures of non-for-profit law. Then we're going to go into the philosophy of nonprofit practice. I was a philosophy major in college, and so I always have to give you the philosophy of X, Y, or Z, sort of what experience has taught me about how to deal with nonprofit law in general. Then I'm going to give you some tools of the trade, some things that are not they're not specifically things that lawyers do, but it's stuff that lawyers need to deal with in the nonprofit space, especially if you are representing a charitable organization or any kind of tax-exempt organization looking to raise funds. It's important to understand the tools that they have in their proverbial belt so that you can advise them accordingly. Next, we're going to talk about how nonprofit organizations can mitigate risk. Because it just like any other corporate entity, a non-for-profit takes on risk, and that risk can be mitigated in various ways. And they're going to go into private inurement issues. This would be, I would consider, the bane of a non-for-profit, the idea that that these tax-exempt organizations are not allowed to give excessive benefit to a private person. We'll talk about what that means and how you can get your clients to avoid that problem. Then we're going to go into non-for-profits in different aspects of society. We'll go through non-profits in business, non-profits in religion, and non-profits in politics. These are certain rules surrounding non-profits that handle these different avenues of life. So, all that said, let's get into the basics. First and foremost, what is a nonprofit organization? So the way I define nonprofit, and it may be a little surprising to you, is a corporation which is organized for a purpose other than the generation of profits to be distributed to equity holders. Now, technically speaking, a nonprofit organization does not need to be a corporation, although it usually is. In the United States, at any rate, in other countries, it's a little different, but in the United States, a nonprofit organization can be a corporation, it can be a trust, it could be an LLC, so long as those every member of the LLC is a nonprofit organization itself. But the vast majority of the time, it is a corporation. And the reason why I bring this up and I want to make it super duper clear is, a non-profit organization or NPO is a non-stock corporation. What does that mean? That means that there's no equity and therefore no ownership. So even though a corporation, as we all know, has its own version of personhood in the law, usually it's based on, who owns the equity in the entity. With a nonprofit organization, especially those that are corporations, which again are the vast majority of the time, there are no equity owners of the organization. Why? Because these corporations, by their very nature, do not have stock. So a lot of times, if you go to different states, Department of State websites, you're going to form an entity. Sometimes they'll say, oh, you're forming this under the non-for-profit law. Or sometimes they'll say, you are forming a non-stock corporation. It's not allowed to issue shares. Why? Because it doesn't belong to the people who run the organization. It's only via stewardship So it's you cannot own a nonprofit, but you can control a nonprofit by virtue of the fact that you are on the board of a nonprofit organization. Now, with all of that said, the fact that a nonprofit organization does not itself issue stock does not preclude a nonprofit organization from owning equity in another entity. So other than the fact that there's no issuance of shares for these nonprofit corporations, everything else about a nonprofit applies the exact same way as it does to a corporation. That said, nonprofits are not automatically tax exempt on the federal or state level. They must apply first for that status. There is one big exception to that. And that are that's churches, or if I need to be, you know, if I really should be most inclusive, places of worship. There is a particular section of the tax code, I believe it's 5081A, which states that churches, synagogues, mosques, and other places of worship, by their very nature, are tax exempt and do not require registration with the IRS as such. This can be problematic for some folks. A lot of times, and I've seen this happen a lot. A church will say, "Well, we don't need to file." Okay, that's technically true. You don't technically need to file, but if you do file, there are a lot of different benefits, and or rather more likely, more specifically, if you do file, then you are less likely to be less likely to be audited simply because the IRS sees you as, you know, as coming in in a non-adversarial way. But that's only the case on the federal level. On the state level, regardless, you still need to apply for tax exempt status. But for the vast majority of the time, you not nonprofit organizations are not automatically tax exempt. So, with that having been said, let's move into the excuse me. Well, there's one more basic slide I want to go through, and then we're going to go through forming a nonprofit in five easy steps. So, nonprofits with exempt status do not pay tax from income, generally speaking. That's not always the case. It depends on where that money is coming from. So, let me give you an example. A 501c6 organization, you know, a business league or chamber of commerce, that in of itself does not pay tax on its income. And 501c7 organizations, which are recreational organizations and fraternities and the like, they don't pay tax off on the income at the corporate level. So what is the difference between that and say a 501c3? Only a 501c3 exempt organization can provide a tax deduction to their donors as a quote unquote charitable deduction. That is the only one. That is why 501c3 gets its own application that is separate and distinct from every other tax exemption application at the federal level. But it's still, even though a nonprofit organization is not necessarily a 501c3, so long as it has the tax exempt status on the federal and state level, it is not paying tax on the income that it takes in. Why? The whole idea behind the nonprofit is that the funds are being used towards a tax exempt purpose, whether it be a charity or a church or a chamber of commerce or something like that. In this case, as I like to say, Uncle Sam has decided you can take money out of my pocket specifically for this thing. So, let's go into forming a nonprofit in five easy steps. So, step one, file articles of incorporation with the applicable state's Secretary of State's office, and also apply for a federal tax ID number, also known as the FEIN or Federal Employer Identification Number, and if applicable, a state tax ID number. Why am I saying if applicable? Because some state tax authorities say that you can just you they just file you under your EIN anyway, and there's no state equivalent. That is, you know, most states don't do that. Most states have their own type of tax, excuse me, tax identification number for these purposes. So, you know, keep that in mind. Now, once you have your tax ID numbers and you've filed your articles of incorporation with your state, let's just, because I'm happen to be in the state of New York, let's take it as an example. You're filing in the state of New York. You've filed with the New York Secretary of State's office. You have your EIN, which you received by doing an online application. It takes 5 minutes. It doesn't cost you anything. And your state tax ID number is automatically issued by the state taxation department. So step two, have the initial board meeting for the NPO. This is sometimes called an incorporation meeting. For those of you who are well-versed in corporations law. So what happens at an initial board meeting? Well, three things need to happen, right? There are a lot of things that can happen, but three things that must happen at the initial board meeting, also known as an incorporation meeting. Number one, elect an initial board of directors. Number two, adopt your bylaws. And three, if applicable to your particular kind of nonprofit, adopt a conflict of interest policy. If you are going for 501c3 status, you are absolutely going to want to adopt a conflict of interest policy. If simply because the IRS is going to, they say they don't technically require it. However, I've never seen a 501c3 application that doesn't involve a conflict of interest policy pass muster with the IRS. I would say 99.98% of the time, if you are applying for 501c3 status, you really should have a conflict of interest policy adopted from the get-go. So now that you have adopted your bylaws, elected your initial board of directors and officers, if applicable, then, and you have adopted your conflict of interest policy, again, if applicable, then the next step is to apply for federal tax exempt status. Now, there are three forms I want to make you aware of here. There's 1023, I call that the vanilla 1023. That is the 501c3 related application. That's a long form application. This is for the vast majority of 501c3 applications, you go with 1023. Form 1023EZ, called that because it's easy. That is for a small amount of, I would say, a small minority of tax exempt applications. There are a few rules, or rather should I say parameters, for being able to use the 1023EZ. And the big three that I like to mention in things like this is, number one, if you're expecting the organization to make less than $50,000 a year in gross income. Number one. Number two, if this non-for-profit is not going to operate overseas, you know, in foreign countries. And number three, if it is a standalone organization, if it's not part of a group exemption. So your 1023EZ is good short form. It is processed a lot faster than the 1023. Generally speaking, a 1023 takes between 90 days and forever to be processed. I don't say that just to be cheeky here. I say it because I have seen 1023 applications. I've seen them be processed in 6 weeks. I've seen them processed in a year. I've seen them processed in 9 months. It really does run the gamut based upon, you know, how things are happening at the IRS. The 1023EZ, however, by virtue of the regulation that propagated this form, must be processed within 60 days of receipt by the IRS. So, if your client is a would-be nonprofit organization and 1023EZ applies to them, they fall within that that scope. I would highly recommend that you have them file their via 1023EZ. Now, 1023 and 1023EZ, that's only 501c3. It's only charitable organizations. Now, Form 1024, this is an omnibus for the rest of them. There are 21 different subsections of 501c, Section 501c of the Internal Revenue Code. And 501c3 has their own two forms. By virtue of the fact that, you know, there's a tax deduction for the donors associated with it, there is a lot more scrutiny there. But 1024 is an omnibus form. Every other kind of non-for-profit organization that's recognized by the Federal Internal Revenue Code, you apply for exempt status via the 1024 form. So what do I mean? I mean everything from a business league to a fraternity to an unincorporated cemetery. Yes, that is a tax-exempt organization under 501c. I know, it's weird. And there are a lot more. But those, that's really, you know, that kind of runs the, that kind of gives you the range. We're going to go into some of the specifics on some of the more common non-501c3 types in detail in a little bit. So you'll see a lot of that. Now, once you have made that application, oh, and I should make you aware, it is the day of the recording today is March 9th, 2020. As of January 1st, 2020, the IRS no longer accepts in-mail applications for either the 1023, the 1023EZ, or the 1024. Every application for tax exempt status for the federal level must be sent via pay.gov. So for my clients, here's how I generally do it. Once I have the all the information required from the client to put their 1023 or their EZ or their 1024 together, I open a pay.gov account for them, specifically for the nonprofit organization. I populate the form for them, and then I send them an email saying, okay, we're now ready to go. Here's your, here are your login credentials for your nonprofit's pay.gov account. You know, here's your username, and username is always, of course, the name of the organization. And then the password is always just a placeholder that we say, go ahead and, you know, change it whenever you want. And what they're supposed to do is if they have to look over the form of the application, if they approve, then they sign it electronically online and they pay the application fee, which used to be based on how much the organization is expected to bring in over the course of its first 3 years of operation. However, it has since changed to a flat $400, I believe it's $400 per application. Doesn't matter the size of the application. That change happened maybe 2 years ago. So, so two big changes, at least for those of you who have been doing this for a long time. Number one is everything's now via pay.gov. And number two, the application fee, what they used to call a user fee, no longer is based on the financial estimates of the organization. It's now a flat fee. So let's say you've gone through your step three, you've applied for your federal tax exempt status, and you get your determination letter. Your determination letter will come in the mail. You are only going to get it once. So please, please, please scan it, tattoo it to the inside, you know, to the back of your neck. Well, maybe don't do that. But make sure that you hold it safe. Maybe put a copy in the safe deposit box. Just make sure you don't lose it. It's a lot like your EIN letter. The federal, the IRS does not issue extra copies of that. So just be aware of it. So once you've received your federal tax exempt status via this determination letter, then you apply for state or municipal tax exempt status. I say state or municipal because in some cities, like here in the city of New York, we have a separate tax authority that you need to make a separate application. Now, once you're done with that, then you have step five, and this only applies to charitable organizations. By charitable, I mean an organization that is going to openly solicit donations to the general public. If you have one of those, or if your client is a nonprofit that is one of those, you have one extra step. And that extra step is to register the nonprofit with the state attorney general's office. Here in New York, we have, it's called the Charities Bureau. Every state in the union has its own version of this. It is the registration. It's usually once a year registration that every nonprofit needs to go through in order to not only keep their exempt status at the state level for a given year, but also to be allowed to openly solicit on the ground members of the public within that state. Now, some nonprofit organizations, actually a lot of nonprofit organizations, they will do fundraisers in other states. And there is a registration process for out-of-state, what we call foreign organizations that want to raise funds in another state. Let's give an example. So New York and New Jersey, there's a lot of overlap between them, especially for those folks in the city of New York and those folks who are living in, you know, Bergen County, you know, that sort of northern Jersey area. A nonprofit organization in the state of New Jersey may want to have an event in the state of New York. There's certainly a lot of merit to that idea. And so if they do that, what they want to do is register their nonprofit in the state of New York with their charities bureau. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, they want to make sure that the funds that they bring in during that New York event are not subject to New York state tax. Number two, to the extent that they want to openly solicit donations at the in that state, and if you're going to have a fundraiser event, I don't see how you're not going to be doing that, then you want to make sure you're registered, otherwise you can get punished for it. And number three, and this is something that not a lot of people think about, but it is important, if your nonprofit is going to sell things like, you know, t-shirts, bumper stickers, you know, swag, you know, that sort of thing, you want to make sure that those things are not subject to state or municipal sales tax. You can only get that if you register with the Charities Bureau in that state. Now, you don't have to make a separate application with every single state and municipal tax department in order to get that exemption. If you are a nonprofit in another state, so here in the state of New Jersey, you can just do one filing in the state of New York and you're good to go. So that is something you definitely want to consider if you are doing these fundraisers. But just to put a cap on it, step five, register the nonprofit with the Charities Bureau or State Attorney General's office. Maybe it's not called the Charities Bureau in your state. Maybe it's called something else. So once you have all of that, you are done. You mazel tov. Congratulations. You've officially formed a nonprofit organization. So having gone through all that, now let's go through the philosophy of nonprofit law. This is, you know, where I sort of pontificate on you. My apologies in advance. So something that, now that we've gone through the basics of nonprofit law and I've gone through some of the mechanics of it, let's go through the sort of ivory tower philosophy. So as I was stating before, nonprofit organizations are corporations that don't have equity units. Therefore, they should be treated by attorneys like you and me exactly the way they treat their for-profit clients, with some additional considerations. Those additional considerations being, you know, the regulatory challenges that these organizations face, such as additional reporting requirements, you know, making sure that everything is handled properly to keep your tax-exempt status, etc. So because a nonprofit is a corporation that doesn't have equity, you know, it's still subject to effectively all the same rules as a corporation on the corporate compliance level, but they have this additional level put on top of it by virtue of the fact that they are a nonprofit organization. Now, in some ways that may sound like it's constrictive, but I would actually argue the exact opposite. I find that it's actually quite freeing. Because a nonprofit organization, if you look at it like a corporation with a couple of different steps added to it, you can take the corporate toolkit, especially the corporate finance toolkit that you've already developed in your corporate practice, and apply it to these tax-exempt organizations. And it can be a lot of fun. So that is something you may want to consider if you're a corporate person who is looking to do some nonprofit law. So point number two here, tax exemption and donation deductions take money from Uncle Sam's pocket in furtherance of a nonprofit purpose for the public good. This is just the nature of nonprofit organizations in general. So now you may think, well, donation deductions take money from Uncle Sam's pocket. You may argue that tax exemption by its very nature doesn't. I would say that's not true.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is OFF. O-F-F. All lowercase. OFF. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is OFF. O-F-F. All lowercase. OFF. Please take a moment and write this down.
True that with every accession to wealth that any kind of entity, either individual or corporate or something else, get access to, that is theoretically income under the Internal Revenue Code. And so every time you have any kind of exemption of any kind, you are taking money out of Uncle Sam's pocket in furtherance of a nonprofit purpose, i.e. a purpose which the government has decided they want to encourage financially with this incentive. Now, note that not every nonprofit organization has the deduction associated with it. However, every nonprofit organization has the exemption, or rather should I say, can apply for and can receive an exemption towards collection of taxes against it at the corporate level. So either way, it's taking money out of Uncle Sam's pocket in furtherance of a nonprofit purpose, you know, for the public good. Now, nonprofit attorneys like me and maybe you don't have to personally agree with the nonprofit's purpose, but they still need to use their best judgment when they are dealing with the nonprofit. Look, sometimes you're going to disagree with your clients. I think that's the case for no matter what kind of legal practice you are in. But I find with the nonprofit organization, that can happen more often than not. I think perhaps by virtue of the fact that it's tax exempt, a lot of folks think that it's only for a particular kind of doing good. Just to give you an example here, one of the types of organizations that I often deal with is a 501c4, which is what's always a social action organization. Sometimes it's also known as a political action committee. And I've actually taught other CLEs about how to do campaign finance via so-called nonprofit organizations like that, but that's a story for another day. I often find that that folks who are applying for tax-exempt status on the social action side, they run the political gambit. Sometimes I do not agree with their politics. Sometimes I vehemently disagree with their politics. Really does depend on a variety of factors. However, that's okay. You have to use your best judgment when you are dealing with the client who's saying that they are in the tax exempt sphere and they want to use, you know, they want to do something in particular and apply for tax exempt status. Sometimes I will tell a client, hey, I don't think this in any way should get tax exempt status, and then I'm proven wrong and the IRS gives it to them anyway. One time in particular that I'm thinking about from maybe 5 years ago was this nonprofit that I did a 501c3 application for. It was a so-called nonprofit game show, but it was designed in such a way that it was pretty clear to me that it was going to act and work exactly like a for-profit game show, except maybe 10% of its proceeds would go to a charity. I wrote the 1023 application entirely truthfully, within the scope of every question, made everything very clear, and the IRS gave them tax exempt status anyway. So use your best judgment, but sometimes the IRS will surprise you, and sometimes they'll surprise you in a good way. Now, there are some additional considerations you need to think about when you are working with nonprofits. First and foremost, tax exempt status must be managed concurrently on the federal and state levels. One does not automatically manage the other. Now, it's much easier to get state tax exempt status if you are already federally tax exempt. In fact, every single state tax exemption application I've ever seen asks for a copy of your federal tax exemption letter as an attachment, just as a standard operating procedure, but you know, that just is what it is. But just because that's the case does not mean it's an automatic thing. So you have to manage them concurrently on the federal and state levels. Now, nonprofit clients need to be disabused of the idea that nonprofit activities don't come with risk. A lot of times people will come to me and say, well, it's a nonprofit, I don't have to think about insurance. It's a nonprofit, I don't have to think about liability. Who would sue a nonprofit organization? Everybody and anybody, because this is America. Everybody sues everybody for whatever reason, or sometimes even no reason at all. It is a thing. So, you know, you have to disabuse your, or rather, this is, you know, my personal opinion, hence why it's philosophy of nonprofit law and not doctrine of nonprofit law. You know, nonprofit clients need to be disabused of the idea that because they are tax exempt, because they're a nonprofit activity, that they are somehow also exempt from the rest of the risks having to do with any kind of endeavor out there in the world. And finally, the exempt purpose of a nonprofit is a fiduciary duty to which officers and directors of that nonprofit are held. This is effectively in addition to, or rather, I more accurately say, it's melded with or fused with the duties of care and loyalty. Every corporate lawyer knows that a officer or director of a corporation, tax exempt or not, has the twin fiduciary duties, of care and loyalty to the company. Now, with respect to a regular for-profit entity, those duties of care and loyalty are to the company with respect to, you know, making its profit, and also, of course, to its investors to the extent that it has it. Whereas with a nonprofit organization, you are specifically not there to make profit. You're, instead of the profit-making mode of the nonprofit is there for a particular tax-exempt purpose. And so the lens through which the fiduciary duties of loyalty and care are viewed is through the exempt purpose of the organization. So keep that in mind when you're dealing with a nonprofit who is, you know, who's either 501c3 or any other form of nonprofit. You know, their duties of loyalty and care are not applied to the profit-making motive. And a lot of times they'll think a nonprofit client, especially one who's not super sophisticated, will say because of the fact that they're nonprofit doesn't mean they have the fiduciary duties of loyalty and care. Actually, quite the opposite. If you are running a nonprofit organization and you do not fulfill your fiduciary duties of loyalty and care, you could get in more trouble than you would otherwise. Why? Because if you're, rather should I say, the mechanism by which an investor or, you know, shareholder in a corporation enforces those duties against the directors and officers or a company are civil in nature. They sue. They do what's called derivative action or derivation action. However, with a nonprofit organization, you don't have that because there are no equity holders. Now, a lot of clients come to me falsely thinking that SACT completely, you know, exempts them from this. However, they are quite easily disabused of that when I'd say, well, if someone thinks that you're doing the wrong thing with your nonprofit, they don't sue you because they can't by law. What they do is they make a complaint to the Attorney General's office of that of your state, and then that state Attorney General's office investigates you and then possibly fines you or worse. So, you know, again, you got to make sure that your nonprofit clients understand that just because they're a nonprofit does not mean they get to just play around. So let me get off my soapbox here about philosophy of nonprofit law. Let's move into some tools of the trade. These are some other types of entities and organizations that can help a nonprofit, and they're really just specifically meant for certain tax-exempt entities. So the three that I'm going to go through with you today. First is fiscal sponsorships, then friends of organizations, and finally professional fundraisers. So fiscal sponsorships, what are those? A fiscal sponsorship is a contractual arrangement in which a 501c3 organization effectively extends their tax-exempt status to an organization which also has a nonprofit purpose but doesn't itself have tax-exempt status. This is something that's rather common when you have a nonprofit that is in formation but hasn't received this 501c3 status yet. In fact, I do this all the time. I find that nonprofit clients who want to start, they want to start, you know, after they've already been fully formed, but they haven't gotten their tax exempt status yet. They still want to solicit donations. They still want to be able to provide they still want to provide a tax deduction to their donors. And the way you do that is by making a contractual arrangement with another 501c3 organization in the form of a fiscal sponsor. So how does it work mechanically speaking? Fiscal sponsors take in the donations directly. They provide 501c3 compliant receipts to their donors, and then they distribute funds to the sponsored organizations. Now, the sponsored organization does not need to be incorporated separately. However, that is helpful for liability protection purposes. Sometimes, and I have seen this happen a lot, a nonprofit, you know, isn't fully formed yet. Like, they haven't even filed their articles of incorporation yet, but they still want to solicit donations. They still want to do good. So they'll have a fiscal sponsor with the sponsored entity is a nonprofit in formation or an unincorporated nonprofit entity, which can be a little messy because for liability protection purposes, there's no corporate veil between them. So to the extent that I represent entities that are performing fiscal sponsorship, it does happen occasionally. I usually advise them to only provide fiscal sponsorship to nonprofit entities that are fully formed, especially those that are fully formed specifically for a tax exempt purpose, usually under the same exemption that the fiscal sponsoring organization, the sponsor, has itself. Now, fiscal sponsors have a fiduciary duty to ensure that the funds they take in and distribute are used for nonprofit purposes. So, you know, usually a nonprofit, sometimes they take a service fee, a percentage of the funds. But whether you do or you don't take a sponsorship fee, you still are responsible for making sure that the funds are being used in accordance with whatever particular subsection of the Internal Revenue Code you have tax exempt status for. So look, technically speaking, a fiscal sponsorship could have to do with any kind of nonprofit. It can be a 501c3, it can be a 501c4, it could be a C7, a C8. Again, we'll go into those in more detail later, but usually it's a C3, but it can be literally any other type of fiscal sponsorship. The only difference here is that you don't really get a donation, you don't really get a tax deduction for non-501c3 related organizations, with the exception of 501c6. 501c6 is, as I stated before, a trade organization or a chamber of commerce. That is usually deductible as a business expense as opposed to as a donation. I think it's the only other type of tax exempt status where I would even contemplate a fiscal sponsorship, but the vast majority of the time, it's 501c3 charitable nonprofits. Now, as I said before, fiscal sponsors generally take a percentage of the funds received as a service fee. This percentage taken varies wildly, and there are nonprofit organizations that do this professionally, and that's all that they do. If you are representing a fiscal sponsor, make sure that you have a strong clawback provision and auditing capabilities. Why? Because as the fiscal sponsor, you have that fiduciary duty to ensure that the funds that are distributed to their sponsored organizations, or sponsorees, if you will, are used for, in this case, 501c3 exempt purposes. And if you do not have the ability, by contract, to claw that money back, and you're audited by the IRS and they say, okay, where did that fiscal sponsorship money go? And you say, I don't know. Or it turns out that it was used to line someone's pockets and you had no way of correcting that. Well, that puts your organization, the sponsoring organization, in a lot of trouble. So definitely very important that whenever you're dealing with a fiscal sponsorship agreement, make sure you have clawback provision, a strong one, and auditing capabilities so that you at least have that fig leaf of protection for your client. Now, the second tool of the trade that I want to go through are friends of organizations. So what is a friends of organization? Friends of organization are separately incorporated nonprofits that exist as fundraising conduits for a specific NGO, right? NGO, a non-governmental organization, is the international equivalent of a nonprofit organization outside the United States. Why is this? Because a non-governmental organization cannot simply waive in to tax-exempt status in the United States. You can't say have a Japanese nonprofit just waive in to American tax-exempt status the way, say, a New York attorney can waive in to, say, say the Georgia, the practice law there. It's not that kind of relationship. So friends of organizations must have a separation of management between themselves and the non-governmental organization to which their funds are distributed. You need to have that separation. You need to have that corporate veil. Otherwise, it's just a blatant agency relationship, and the IRS is not going to be happy with that. So if you are dealing with a friends of organization that is 501c3 related, and yes, that is a thing that does happen, a friends of organization must provide details as to the non-governmental organization which will receive their funds, the management of that non-governmental organization, and the forms of control they will have on the use of tax-exempt funds. That goes back to what we were talking about earlier in fiscal sponsorships, but having a strong clawback provision and auditing provisions. Because once again, per the philosophy of nonprofit law, when you have a friends of organization, they are taking money out of Uncle Sam's pocket and they are giving it to, in this case, an entity overseas. So you need to make sure that within your agreements between the friends of organization and the target nonprofit or target non-governmental organization that there are strong clawback provisions, because those fiscal duties still exist. Now, a friends of organization is ultimately responsible for how its NGO handles donated funds. So strong grant agreement with financial oversight and clawback provisions, again, is essential. I can't emphasize that enough. Now, if a friends of organization is handling large amounts of money, and yes, as Einstein says, everything's relative, so that was a relative term. However, I would say if you are handling amounts of money over $10,000, I think it's a really good floor for that, then they may want to have signatory access to the NGO's operations account as additional security. If the friends of organization is providing large amounts at a given time, like $50,000 or $100,000 at a time, and they want to make sure that the NGO in question that they're providing this money to is using it properly, having signatory access on those large transactions at the banking level can be helpful. Now, one last thing about friends of organization I need to mention, and this sucks, but it is what it is. Friends of African organizations, meaning friends of organizations that have an African-based NGO that they are providing donations to, generally undergo heightened scrutiny with the IRS. I mean, call it racism, call it xenophobia, call it whatever you want. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm saying it simply is what it is. I find that that IRS caseworkers will for some reason, or even no reason at all, provide higher scrutiny towards African nonprofits than nonprofits anywhere else. Once again, it simply is what it is. Now, the last tool of the trade I want to make you aware of is a professional fundraiser. Professional fundraisers can be a really useful tool for larger nonprofits to obtain sponsors for events and obtain other forms of donations. Professional fundraisers and professional grant writers sometimes overlap in skill sets, but technically speaking, they're not the same thing. A professional fundraiser is somebody who goes out and raises money for the organization and usually takes a piece of the pie, so to speak, as their payment. Whereas a professional grant writer, they're not actively raising money. They simply write a grant application and see it through to the end. Now, sometimes they get a piece of the action and sometimes they don't. A lot of times I find the professional grant writers are paid by the hour or by the application. But now, what is the big difference? If you are a professional fundraiser, then you must register with the Charities Bureau of the states in which you work. So, you know, every Charities Bureau, including the state of New York, has a professional fundraisers registration. Additionally, each Charities Bureau has different standards for professional fundraising services contracts in their particular state. Now, one thing you need to be fully aware of is that if your client uses a professional fundraiser service, their contract with the professional fundraiser must be registered with the local Charities Bureau. It is not enough that your nonprofit client is working with a professional fundraiser that is registered themselves. You also must register the contract with the local Charities Bureau. And a lot of times a professional fundraiser will say that they'll do it. Sometimes they won't. I would just add an abundance of caution. I generally recommend that nonprofit clients do it themselves. Worst comes to worst, you have two filings that are the same. You have a little bit of redundancy, but ultimately at the end of the day, you're still covered. Now, professional fundraisers generally work on contingency, meaning they take a percentage of the gross revenue attributable to their services. Note, I said gross revenue. Beware the expenses trap. This is a thing that professional fundraisers do, the more unscrupulous ones do all the time, whereby they, you know, rack up huge expenses onto the account. And then get, sometimes they're necessary, sometimes they're not. Like a necessary one would be, you know, we had to hire a DJ for this event, and an unnecessary one is, well, you had to fly me, the professional fundraiser, business class all over the world specifically to do this. And usually they take their fees off of the gross, meaning what they'll do is either they will charge the expenses directly to the nonprofit, or more likely for the larger professional fundraisers, what they do is they charge up whatever they want on their own expense accounts, and then they deduct their expenses. They reimburse themselves off the top from whatever was raised by the nonprofit via their services, and that's in addition to their fee. So just to give you an example, let's say that this fundraiser successfully raises $100,000 for a nonprofit, and they racked up $20,000 in expenses, and they have a 10% fee that they associate with their services. Well, they are going to take the first 10% off the top. So my fee is 10%. So I take $10,000 off the top. I then need to reimburse myself $20,000. And so now we have left over $70,000 for the actual nonprofit. Now, that's not an egregious one. I have seen professional fundraisers who, you know, they live high off the hog, so to speak, on that type of contract. So just be aware of the expenses trap. What I generally tell nonprofit clients who are considering a professional fundraiser type relationship is to have a certain conditions put in place. For example, commercial travel only, coach only, things like, you know, any expense over $5,000 needs to be approved by the nonprofit before it's expense, you know, that kind of thing. So now that we've gone through some of the tools of the trade, let's talk about some of the ways in which a nonprofit can mitigate risk. So first and foremost, when you are dealing with grants, make sure we're on the same page here. A grant is where one organization provides funds to another organization, either for a specific purpose, it's called a purpose grant, or for their operation in general, that's called an operations grant. So as an attorney, when you're representing the grantor, the granting organization, the grant application must filter out undesirable applicants using a balance of business considerations and tax considerations. So if you understand that, you know, your company, your nonprofit client is they're taking applications, make sure that it is weeding out the undesirables. The worst thing you can do is cast too wide of a net. Now, for international grants, it's really helpful to have a third-party administrator or trustee for the grant. Why? Because you have a fiduciary duty as a nonprofit organization to make sure that your grantees are handling the funds properly. And the IRS loves to see financial oversight by a third party. Now, as I've stated with multiple other things today, it does bear repeating, auditing clawback provisions are key to grant agreements. Warranty.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is SIT, S-I-T, all lowercase, SIT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is SIT, S-I-T, all lowercase, SIT. Please take a moment and write this down.
Warranties of the grantee, representations and warranties by the grantee as to the use of funds should be taken directly from the statutory language of Internal Revenue Code Section 501. All right. So what I generally do is I take the statutory language for like what exact purposes the funds should be used for, and I take it directly from whatever tax exempt section the organization is claiming, so that, worst comes to worst, if there's an issue, you can say, look, there are representations and warranties that you're going to use the funds in accordance with, say, 501c3 or 501c6. And finally, when you're representing the granting organization, the grantor, make sure to obtain enough information about the grantees for donor reports. Really important. If your client is a nonprofit organization that regularly gives out grants, usually their donors want to know exactly where the money's going. It's also helpful for marketing purposes. Now, let's flip the script. What happens if you're representing a grant recipient? Well, four things you want to consider. Number one, ensure that your client is using the funds within the scope of their grant. The worst thing they can do is just start paying themselves out of it, unless it's a general purpose grant, in which case salaries are okay. Now, operational grants and project grants must be treated differently. As I stated before, operational grants are more general. It could be used for almost anything that the grantee's organization does. Whereas a project grant, every single dime of that grant must be used for a particular project, so you must treat them differently. I would actually, go ahead and argue that advise that that the nonprofit organization should open a separate, bank account, usually a sub account within their bank account, specifically for the project related grants. It's usually helpful for accounting purposes. Now, make sure your client keeps meticulous financial records. That's the case regardless of who your client is, but if they're a grant recipient, even more so. And finally, grant money should never, ever go towards UBIT transactions, unrelated business income tax. What's that? We'll go into that a few slides from now. Now, another tool that a nonprofit can use to mitigate risk is insurance. So, types of actions NPOs often deal with require insurance, or if they don't require insurance, they should have it. Just give you a few examples here. Employment practice related liability, that is insurance coverage that provides protection in the event of a discrimination claim or something along those lines. Personal injury liability, yep, it still happens even though it's a nonprofit. People get hurt, people have to sue because they get hurt. State Attorney General's Act, State Attorney General actions, generally speaking, that is covered under D&O or Director's Officers coverage. Cyber liability, if applicable. Cyber liability is important for those organizations, whether nonprofit or for-profit, that collect personal data and financial data via the internet. Really important stuff. Directors and officers coverage, that's super important. If the nonprofit director or officer is seen to be doing something improper, you want the organization to be able to indemnify that director or officer, and also to be able to hire a lawyer on their behalf. That is why you have liability insurance. Automobile insurance, in the event that a nonprofit organization either owns or is in control of an automobile, and that automobile is in an accident during the while it's doing its work. And finally, event liability. If you are a nonprofit and your nonprofit is doing some kind of event somewhere, usually off-site in some third-party place, usually you want to get event liability insurance. It's not very expensive. It's a little more expensive if alcohol is served at these events, but it is really, really great to have that event liability insurance. Like, spend the extra $100 if needed, because it's usually, you know, a matter of, you know, $100 or $200 for the event, unless the event is massive, of course. But it is not only helpful in for, you know, personal injury related claims, it's also helpful for dram shop related claims. The idea that, you know, the nonprofit is responsible for the drunkenness that it causes. So, you know, be aware of that. Now, brief your client on the claim reporting provisions in their insurance policies, as that can make or break a coverage dispute. That's really important. Now, for fundraising events, make sure you have your client name themselves as an additional insured on their vendor's policies, or rather, should I say, their vendors should name the client as an additional insured on their insurance policies. Really important stuff. Now, another way you mitigate risk is having to do with volunteer liability. Now, the legal principle of respondeat superior applies with a nonprofit organization's volunteers as well as their employees. It's something that a lot of folks, you know, don't think about. Think, well, they're a volunteer, there's no liability there. Yes, yes, they absolutely are. So, nonprofit organizations are also subject to liability for volunteers who are injured during their volunteer activities because they're not subject to workers' compensation like an employee is. Nonprofit organizations' clients tend to think they're exempt from liability in this vein. By virtue of being nonprofit, you have to sort of disallow them of that concept. Now, a few things you can do to mitigate your risk with respect to volunteer liability. You can use personal injury and image consent waivers. You can have comprehensive volunteer training manuals, in-person training of new volunteers. You can make sure you always check for volunteer exclusions in the insurance policies. If you need to buy extra insurance for volunteers by virtue of the fact that your general liability policy does not cover volunteers, I highly suggest you do so. And finally, give employees tasks that need independent judgment. Give volunteers tasks with minimal discretion. Why? Because employees have workers' comp associated with it, whereas volunteers do not. And finally, when mitigating risk, using a conflict of interest policy. Now, New York rules changed a few years ago. It used to be that a New York nonprofit had to always have a conflict of interest policy, and that conflict of interest policy had to be so strict that you could never do any kind of self-dealing ever. That changed recently. Actually, well, recently, it was 2017, so 3 years ago. It changed so that now New York State has adopted the same rule as the IRS, which is to say that if you have a potential conflicted transaction, that you just follow the conflict of interest policy and you're okay. Now, the IRS does require conflict of interest policies for all 501c3 organizations. I mean, technically speaking, I don't say you must have one, but 99.9% of the time, if you don't have one, you don't get the status. Now, some states like New York have their own conflict of interest policy requirements, which should be heeded. Remember to always check your state, which is good advice regardless of the type of practice you're in. Now, conflict of interest policies are also helpful for non-501c3 organizations because adherence to such policies shield those nonprofit organizations from allegations of commingling or private inurement. And finally, annual conflict disclosure forms are required for directors and officers of all nonprofit organizations, all of which should be renewed annually with records carefully maintained. Because what's the point of having a conflict of interest policy if you don't see it through? Now, private inurement problems. We were talking earlier about the idea of excessive benefit being placed to a private person. So here are the problems involved with that. So an excess benefit transaction, what is that? That is a transaction in which a nonprofit organization provides more than fair market value to somebody for something, and that other side happens to be related to the nonprofit of some kind. Let's say, as an example, you have a nonprofit that wants to build a house, and they just give the bid to Billy's Construction Corporation, and Billy's Construction Corporation just so happens to be owned by the chairman of the board of the nonprofit, right? And it happens, and just so happens that's a very profitable bid for Billy's organization. That's what's called an excess benefit transaction. So the consequences of those we'll go into in just a moment. Other kinds of private enrollment problems include excessive compensation to employees. You have to go based on the reasonable compensation standard. What does that mean? That means that you need to go based on what the market is currently paying particular employees for their services. So, for example, you are not going to pay your janitor $150,000 a year unless that is the kind of janitor that does make $150,000 a year. I don't know what kind that is, but it technically could exist, so I'm going to cover my butt there. Now, there is such a thing as a rebuttable presumption of reasonability. I gave you the CFR citation there. However, you have to give it a smell test. If it's the kind of thing where you think it could be considered reasonable based on what the market is paying for that kind of labor, you're okay. But if it seems ridiculous, it probably is. And finally, you got to be aware of what's happening with the flow of tax-exempt funds to privately owned businesses. That is another private enrollment related issue. Now, what are the consequences of private enrollment? Well, you get an excise tax levied upon the disqualified person or entity. If it's pervasive, you can lose your exempt status. So always have your conflict of interest policy in place. And again, make sure you control the flow of exempt funds to privately owned businesses. Now, one thing I want to make you aware of, your IRS notice 2012-52, if you have a single member LLC that is owned entirely by a 501c3 organization, that 501c3 organization's exempt status is imbued onto its wholly owned subsidiary, but it is still separated out for liability purposes, which can be extremely helpful. Now, going to UBIT, the unrelated business income tax. The tax levied on 501c3 organizations specifically for money they collect from ventures which are unrelated to their tax-exempt purpose. That is the key. It has to be unrelated. So as an example, a church can, a church, say, has a bookstore, where you can buy copies of the Bible and things like that. That is not unrelated to the tax-exempt purpose of the organization. However, and this was the case a few years ago, I don't know if it's still the case, but there's a church in Waco, Texas that has a barbecue restaurant that's separated out from the church. It's owned by the church. That is, technically speaking, unrelated to the charitable exempt purpose of the church. So they have to pay the unrelated business income tax on the funds that are made from that activity. Now, unrelated business income tax is taxed at the corporate rate, not the personal rate. Now, deductions such as expenses and depreciation, et cetera, they do count in UBIT calculation. So keep in mind that if your nonprofit is making money on the side in an unrelated trader business, it can still take its expenses for that trader business as deductions off of their UBIT related liability. And finally, whether a 501c3 loses its exemption or not is really guided by the majority of activities thresholds. You need to see how much of the organization's activities are being done, are being guided by the unrelated trader business. If it's the majority, well, then you're probably going to lose your status. If it is a slight minority, maybe make it more of a minority. Really important stuff. Now, there's some common UBIT related situations for nonprofits. I want to go through them quickly. Sale of advertising is almost always considered an unrelated trader business, except for a QSP or qualified sponsorship payment. Qualified sponsorship payment, in brief, is a sponsorship payment in which an endorsement of the business's trade or product or service is not part of it. And the sponsorship is just a thank you to this person, thank you to that company, and having nothing to do with an endorsement or an advertisement. Just a simple thank you for your donation. Now, there's gaming, which is bingo games and raffles. That is usually UBIT. Sale of merchandise and publications can sometimes be unrelated trader business. However, depends on the exempt purpose of the organization. rental income, and parking lots. Also, two very common unrelated trade or business type situations. Now, a quick pro tip, remember the substantial relationship test. If the organization is formed for a particular tax-exempt purpose and the income stream that is coming in is substantially related to the tax-exempt purpose of the organization, you don't have to pay tax on it. If, however, it is not not fully related or substantially related, I should say, to the nonprofit's exempt purpose, well, then you don't have a then you're not likely to be able to avoid the unrelated business income tax. Now, let's go through this quickly. NPOs and businesses, further UBIT considerations. If a venture serves the charitable purpose of your 501c3, then flaunt that whenever possible. If the venture does not serve the charitable purpose, make sure that the venture does not actively hinder the organization's mission. That's a real problem. Proper accounting of expenses and revenue for your nonprofit organization is crucial for compliance. That is generally true, but it's also especially true with the unrelated trade or business. Now, whether or not UBIT applies, disclose the income and expenses on the 990. That is the tax return for the nonprofit organization and state's equivalent submission. And finally, UBIT withholding is a useful tool for to ensure compliance. It can also be offset by additional expenses. We're also going to go through quickly in nonprofit organizations and religion, just really quickly here. When you are dealing with a nonprofit that is religious based, right, a church, synagogue, mosque, what have you, influencing elections or legislation is just straight up banned. You're not allowed to be politically active as a 501c3, especially a religious one. The test that the IRS uses, substantial activities, that's exactly what it sounds like. The expenditure test, meaning look at how much the organization spends towards a political purpose as opposed to the amount of its activities, that test is only available to religious organizations, really important. Now, there is a huge difference between advocacy for a particular thing and election intervention. So as an example, if a church says, look, this year vote your conscience, vote for whatever candidate, works best in accordance with these values, that's one thing. It's another thing to say, go vote for this person because you're a member of this church and this church should vote for this person. That's not okay. Now, there are accepted voter education activities. The idea being that the nonprofit organization, in this case the church, mosque or temple or anything like that, they can educate the voters about issues. They just can't pick a side one way or another with regard to legislation or election. Now, there are non-accepted voter education activities, such as, educating a voter to learn how to canvass for a particular candidate or a particular party. That is a problem. And finally, and this is my favorite, the Meet the Candidates events. A church or other religious organization, they are more than allowed to have town halls and things of that nature where they invite all the candidates over to have questions asked of them. That is okay. Now, let's quickly go through some of the more political activities related here. So we're talking before a 501c4 organization is called a social welfare organization. It's formed exclusively to, quote unquote, promote social welfare. Like their C3 counterparts, C4s are prohibited from, quote unquote, private inurement and excess benefit transactions and are subject to excise taxes as before. However, 501c4 organizations are not required to disclose their donors' identities. That's why super PACs are so opaque. Now, an organization that's lost its C3 status due to substantial attempts to influence legislation may not thereafter qualify as a 501c4 organization. You have to pick it first. Donations to C4 organizations are not tax deductible as charitable donations. And finally, as of 2018, the IRS requires a new form for C4 applications, which is called 1024A. Now, a 501c6 organization is it gives federal tax exemption to business leagues, chambers of commerce, real estate boards, and boards of trade. Once again, private inurement is is prohibited, and donations to C6 organizations are not tax deductible, just as it is with a C4. Now, one last thing I want to make you aware of are some compliance tips. So, always, 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 for every nonprofit, have them file their federal returns. Usually that's Form 990. If you're a 501c3 organization and you do not file for 3 years in a row or more, you automatically lose your status. So please don't do it. There are also annual state filings, especially in New York, pursuant to the Nonprofit Revitalization Act. So be aware of those. As said before, with your conflict of interest policy, make sure that you have board annual disclosures. Keep strong financial records. Keep good corporate records. And what does that mean in this situation? There are two things I would really want to emphasize. All board meetings should have minutes. Make sure they show compliance with the conflict of interest policy. And finally, all board resolutions must be memorialized. Now, in this final slide here, I provided you with some resources for nonprofit organization practitioners, different links that I find very helpful. And finally, if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me via email, todd@kulkinlaw.com. That's todd@kulkinlaw.com. Or you can give me a call, 212-485-9884. That's 212-485-9884. I'm Todd Kulkin. This has been Intro to Nonprofit Law. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. I hope you enjoyed it nearly as much as I enjoyed teaching it. Once again, feel free to reach out. I love hearing from all of you, whether it be positive feedback or not. Doesn't matter. If you want to just shoot the breeze, you have a question or what have you, happy to hear from you. So thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.